that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
Come through a destination for the next up to me. Okay, we'll see what's currently in your way, okay?
There's two of them, and they
stayed
the exact same spot, 05,
but I'm sorry,
like, say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. Come on, Lisa, are you ready for this?
My cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello, and welcome to edition 436 of Strange Days Indeed, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced. UFOs, unidentified flying objects. This week, the 3rd in April 2007, weekly editorial contributor Dave Furlott, a British correspondent and publisher of UFO Review Stuart Miller, UFO magazine contributor and abductee Jeremy Vaney, and to close out this week's program, John Velez. These are Strange Days Indeed. As I keep saying, your feedback to this program is important and useful, and also of great interest to me. So plonk yourself down at your keyboard and let me know what you think. Just as Jeff Hahn did. He keyed, Errol, I just wanted to take you up on your request for suggestions on the podcast in your latest production. First, I want to say that I'm very much enjoying the new formats. Me too. He says, I love the longer shows relative to the old podcast and indeed the radio program. I love your having the freedom to extend segments where necessary, and I love the transition music. And he loves hearing more of Errol Bruce Knapp's own opinions. Well, I guess I'm letting them out slowly. You know, it's the cat in the bag syndrome. And Jeff goes on to address some interesting distribution possibilities, which, Jeff, I'm looking into. And thanks for your email, Jeff. The address, as always, is sdi@virtuallystrange.net.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlott.
There's a thread on the UFO updates list called Ancient Piri-Riez Maps and UFOs. And it sparked some interesting posts, mostly about the map itself, but others touched on different aspects of ancient mysteries and UFOs. My own love of history and ufology makes this thread near and dear to my heart. Now, for those unfamiliar with the Piri-Riez maps, I shall try and simplify it. The Piri-Riez map is a map drawn on the skin of a gazelle by a Turkish admiral back in 1513 based on texts he consulted in the Library of Constantinople. What is most amazing about the map is the detail of the northern coast of Antarctica, a continent that was not to be discovered for another 300 years before he drew it, and it shows Antarctica without ice. Geological evidence confirms that the latest date Queen Maud Land, or Antarctica, could have been charted in an ice-free state is 4000 BC, and the only way to get a relatively accurate map of the region would be from the air. It becomes one of the true ancient mysteries and always sparks debate, with at least one or two people quickly pointing out that only an extraterrestrial influence can account for some of these mysteries. If we look throughout some of the ancient mysteries we have discovered, or believe we have discovered, it would appear that the extraterrestrials influencing our past theory is valid. For example, How is it possible that the ancient Mayan calendar is more accurate and shows more understanding of the movements of the planets around the sun and discovery of planets centuries before we could even see them? How is it possible that the Mayan doctors could perform intricate brain surgery? And most importantly, why did the ancient Mayan civilization simply up and disappear? The more we discover about ancient civilizations, it would seem, the less we truly know. It was believed that Roman soldiers wore leather armor, and this belief was not refuted until archaeological evidence proved it to be false. That evidence was not unearthed until the 1970s. Our entire understanding of ancient history is based on belief more than on evidence, because we simply do not have enough archaeological evidence or any written accounts of many of the ancient civilizations. And that includes some of the largest civilizations we know about: Egypt, Assyria, Persia, Mayans, Aztecs. Even the great European civilizations like Rome and Greece are still misunderstood over 2,000 years later. Up until recently, the great Hittite Empire that was greater than Egypt was almost believed to have been a myth. We have only theories about how Egypt built the pyramids. We have only theories about who built the Sphinx and when. The statues on Easter Island are one of the great mysteries, because it would have meant that the entire population of the island spent all their time making and placing the statues, with no time left over to deal with some of the more mundane things like eating or finding shelter from the elements. And I have only touched on a couple of the ancient mysteries that surround us. There are stories throughout all the ancient civilizations of being visited by beings from the stars. Star people, sky people, airwalkers. It doesn't matter which civilization you choose, you will find something that points to people coming down from the stars or the heavens, and most of them do not refer to these visitors as gods. It has been said by many ufologists that we need to forget about studying the big historical UFO cases like Roswell and concentrate instead on the reports of new UFO sightings. I say that if we concentrate on trying to solve some of the ancient mysteries, that perhaps we may find evidence there could be the link to understanding of the mystery of UFOs that surrounds us. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
Well, there's an instance of you and I both being very firmly in the same boat. Or Vimana, or flying ship.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Exactly.
It's a fascinating series of mysteries that seem to be surfacing. And when you look at the theories on dinosaurs that mm-hmm. are being blown out of the water, and the theories that have been put forth over the years about the universe, and we now notice how the universe is changing according to science, then we are left with the inevitable conclusion that we don't know nothing.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those situations where we get nailed with all of these things that are supposedly facts, and then 50 years, 100 years later, pow, blown right out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
Right out of the water.
Yes.
Like I said, even the great civilizations, Rome, we supposedly know everything about Rome. Well, guess what, folks? No, we don't. Okay? So how can we expect to look at a civilization that was 2,000 or 3,000 years before Rome and say, yeah, well, we know everything about that place?
Yeah.
<You know? laughs> And we look at some of the stuff that they've done that we cannot do today. And it's just mind-blowing.
Yes.
You know, it's like, okay, fine, guys, go ahead. Let's build a pyramid. How long do you think it's going to take right now with what we have? Oh, yeah, we might get it done in about 40 or 50 years.
Then... We have to invent the technology to be able to do it with the accuracy that those guys did back whenever it was that they built them.
Exactly. It's not necessarily to say that extraterrestrials came down and said, okay, let's help the Egyptians build some pyramids. No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is perhaps there's a civilization that we don't know anything about that was quite advanced, and that for some reason they either left or they got wiped out or God only knows what.
Or they are still among us, and we are they.
Yes, that's true, too.
Look at the way that humans appeared on this planet. Well, we don't know how they appeared on the planet. Some say that we evolved, and others say that this planet was seeded.
Mm-hmm. Those theories have their validity if you look at them. And again, I stress the term theories, because all of our historical records are just that, theories. There's nothing that has been proven beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Yes. I'm sure that buried in the ancient mysteries is the answer to what it is that we're looking for. And unfortunately, in the same case as Roswell, there is not enough evidence.
Exactly. The evidence is what is missing. When the guys dug up Newstead and came up with what has been termed the Newstead armor for the Romans, and they said, okay, here you go. This is what they were wearing. Well, that's kind of not leather, guys.
Undeniably Roman armor. Yes, absolutely.
They always turn around and go, yeah, this is the piece. And you look at it and you go, yeah, well, it could be. Let's wait a few years and let's have somebody else go, no.
Yes. No, yes. No, yes.
It's like Mars. Mars is one of my favorites. We have these facts that we knew about Mars. It couldn't, you can't, there's no water there, there's no way it could have any kind of an atmosphere, yada, 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 yada. Oh, well, we might have been wrong.
Yes, well, go ahead, leave us with a cliffhanger, Dave Furlot.
What could I tell you?
Say goodbye, Dave.
Okay. Talk to you next week.
Okay, thank you, sir. Yet again, a good take.
Thank you.
Once a month, we head across the Atlantic to the United Kingdom. In England, there's our British correspondent, Stuart Miller, joins us every month, and right now is no exception. Joining us on the line from his home in Cheshire in the United Kingdom is our British correspondent and publisher of UFO Review, Stuart Miller. Good day, sir.
And a very good day to you and to everybody listening.
How goes it over there?
Mild, pleasant, ufologically middling. Last time I think it was dull, this time it's just stepped up ever so slightly. We had a sighting of a UFO, or was it a satellite, or was it a UFO, or was it a satellite in Barrow yesterday?
Barrow in Furness, yes.
Indeed. A really bizarrely located place. I don't know if you know the map of the UK, but it's always been my desire to go and visit it for no reason, because there's nothing there at all.
Mm.
It's just in a rather silly place. I suspect, actually, knowing, bearing in mind its location, which is sort of bordering on the Irish Sea, and it's not that far from Scotland, and I suspect it might be sort of on the edge of one of the fly-through zones, testing grounds for various paraphernalia.
Ah, yes. Paraphernalia mostly from this side of the pond, huh?
Yes, or even some of our own stuff. You know, the Solway Firth, that area is, I think the military have zones up or around there. I could be wrong, it could be something of more interest than that, but it certainly brightened up that guy's Chinese takeaway meal.
Yeah, I love the headline, while eating Chinese. Well, how many Chinese were they eating?
Exactly. That's what they do in Barrow anyway, they eat Chinese.
Oh my.
It's funny how one thing leads on to another, because our two favourite sceptics, Dave Clark and Andy Roberts, have just had a book published. The book's called Flying Sorcerers, A Social History of Ufology by Clark and Roberts. And it is actually Flying Sorcerers, not Saucers. Published by Alternative Albion, it is indeed exactly what the title says. It's a look at the social sociological side or aspect of ufology, in the UK that is, that's important that I make that designation because it's not universal ufology, just British ufology. From 1948 to 1979, the reason I make that definition and specify that it is British as opposed to universal is because British ufology is unique in one aspect in that it is totally and completely filled with nutcases. Whereas I think across the board, internationally, there are plenty of nutcases about, but also more level-headed people as well.
Yes.
But
yes.
In Britain, you get a level of eccentricity that is unmatched in most other places. And that's really the beauty of the subject, the attraction of the subject. Whether ET exists or not isn't the focus of the book. Cases aren't the focus of the book, except where they come up in relation to a specific individual. People are the focus of the book, and it's about how ufology came over here, which is probably about 3 years after it started in the States, or it's sort of about 1950 it came over here substantially, and who the main characters were, and the sort of people, and so on and so forth. If you're into that side of it, if you like ufology for the cultural impact it's had on, well, certainly on British society, then this is a book for you. It's published by Alternative Albion. There is a website, publisher's website, and I'll repeat the title again, Flying Sorcerers, The Social History of Ufology. Now, I was hesitating a moment ago when I said that UK ufology sort of took off in 1950. I think I might have said 1950-ish. I was talking to Dave Clark about this, and during the course of the conversation, he reminded me of something, which isn't new, but when you know of something and then you forget about it, and you're reminded about it, it can make quite an impact on you. And I was absolutely gobsmacked, as we say over here, when I was reminded about this. And it is that in 1948, a British gentleman by the name of Bernard Newman, who went on to become a very prolific author, wrote a book called The Flying Saucer. And bizarrely, considering that ufology hadn't got over here yet, it is considered to be one of the very first books on the subject in the modern time.
Mm.
And the fact it was written by a Brit. Is it a book you've heard of, Errol?
No, I haven't. No, not even when I was young and interested in going to the library looking for books on flying saucers in the UK.
Well, then you are in for a shock in a few seconds, because the book was meant to be fiction, and it tells the story about, bear in mind the year, 1948, about a number of UFO crashes throughout the world, including one in New Mexico. It goes on to describe a faked alien autopsy and a plan to create a faked alien threat to try and unite the world.
Really?
As well as hoaxed alien crashes designed to add weight to the threat synopsis. Or hypothesis, rather.
My God!
Oh, and stories of hieroglyph-type markings on the wreckage of crashed UFOs. I kid you not. And this was fictional.
My God. Now, this man was either very prescient, or...
No, the situation is even more prosaic and in some ways distressing. He was a member of British intelligence.
Ah. Oh, my goodness.
Yes, it really does pose an awful lot of questions. Dave Clark has an original copy of the book that Newman had given to Captain Basil Liddell Hart, who at the time was head of UK military intelligence, and written in Newman's own hand on the flyleaf were the words, "You may find this amusing. Bernard Newman, 28th of the 10th, 1948.
Good grief.
I know. It is... It beggars belief, actually.
Yes, it does. It's almost a smoking gun, isn't it?
Well, it is, actually. You're right. It is. And the book exists. Copies still exist. You can get a copy and read it yourself. One of the UFO crashes, so this is slightly comical, that occurred internationally was meant to have occurred in Leicester. Well, that's in the UK now, to the best of my knowledge. Nothing's ever landed in Leicester.
In where?
The UFO coming down in Leicester is rather amusing.
Oh, in Leicester. Yes, yeah.
Leicester.
And that's not a known ufological center.
No.
In modern times.
Nothing untoward has ever happened in Leicester. But the rest of it is just bizarre.
That's very strange, Stuart. Good Lord.
I know.
The implications are quite staggering as far as the cover-up is concerned. And intelligence agencies and the attitude of especially North American intelligence agencies toward UFOs.
You're absolutely right, and it just poses so many questions. Because to start with, why would a British intelligence officer need to be involved in this? I just come to a complete, you know, my brain tries to sort of get a grip on this and to sort of try and work out, I suppose, what this might do is just bring back into focus as more likely the possibility that indeed there was an alien event at Roswell. That's what it does for me, because the last few years my mind has very much been in the Nick Redfern camp. I was absolutely convinced that Nick had got it spot on about what happened at Roswell, that it wasn't Mogul, that it was to do with balloons and flying wings and experiments on live human beings.
The book was published, you said, in 1948.
Correct.
So, in my mind, it takes a while to write a book.
It does, though I believe, according to Dave Clark, this man was very prolific later on. I mean, he would be turning out something like 4 books a year.
So it would be possible in the timeline of things for the event to occur in Roswell and the American and British intelligence people to get together, and the British suggesting that they had a man who was an author who would maybe be interested in writing a book that supposedly was fiction in order to cover up whatever events might have happened in Roswell and future events. That's what comes to my mind.
I think we've forgotten something here. We've forgotten the news broadcast, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
The publicity.
Yes. However, did he include that in his book?
That I don't know. Nevertheless, it is deeply intriguing because it does seem to show some foresight of what was to come. It does seem to imply that, well, yes, okay, that there was a cover-up going on.
And they could always point at the book and say, well, this is where it all came from.
Well, for example, there are references to hieroglyphs. I mean, in other words, the wording that Marcel saw, mm-hmm. That wasn't publicized at the time, not for a long time afterwards, actually. And, of course, the alien autopsy was something that didn't come out for another,
That didn't come out until when I first got online with the updates list, which was 96.
Nevertheless, I find the whole thing quite disturbing that it should have been written up in 1948 like that.
That's intriguing. It'll be interesting to see what the field has to say about that as you break this news here, because I doubt that anybody's ever heard of this book.
I did start this off by saying that the book is known about. I'd even vaguely heard something about a while ago.
Yeah, but to my knowledge, it hasn't been discussed publicly at all.
John Rimmer of Magonia wrote something about it a few years ago, and I read his report, actually, in looking up the background on this. John missed the points, the nuances of it all. He didn't see anything conspiratorial about it. I'm not sure he was aware either that Bernard Newman was a member of British intelligence.
And, of course, given that Magonia is very skeptical about things ufological, it would have been something to perhaps deliberately avoid. I don't know what Rimmer was thinking, whether he even noticed that. In view of the Magonia stance on UFOs, it's quite possible that he may have deliberately avoided it. There's an accusation to throw out there, isn't it?
I think the book does ask questions. I think it poses questions that we're not able to answer. Yes, of course, there was a lot of publicity at the time, but there are elements in the book that weren't dealt with at the time, weren't publicized at the time, that Bernard Newman writes about. And it does, as I say, it confuses the issue even more, frankly.
That's probably what it was designed to do when it was written.
Well, indeed.
Yeah. Obfuscate, cloud, plausible deniability. Well, it's all in a book that was fiction.
Let's put Roswell to sleep, which I think is what a lot of people would like to do.
Yes.
And the trouble with Roswell, actually, is it just won't go away. We've lost another one today. I don't know if you've noticed, but Don Ecker has decided to quit UFO research.
Don Ecker has decided to quit research?
Yep. The reason simply is that he's fed up with it.
Don Ecker, who was one of the founders of UFO magazine years ago, the American version. Boy, for him to quit in frustration is certainly something, because he was one of the voices for a long time.
Indeed. It's the usual reasons, just the media, the infighting, etc., 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 etc.
They're all dropping like flies, one way or another.
Everybody has their sort of snapping point. People just become frustrated with the fact that ufology is dead in terms of making progress. Are we any further on down the path, Errol, at this moment in time than we were, say, 10 years ago or 20 years ago?
I have to admit that since I started doing what I do, there have been no advancements at all, other than Chilean, Brazilian, and the French releasing their UFO reports. But there's been nothing substantial over the years at all.
Now, we've had the odd hiccup, like Santilli, where we thought, you know, we might be going somewhere, and there's been other deviations along the route, but in the end, it always comes back to pretty well where we are at the moment.
Yes.
And I suppose you can't blame people if they just get fed up with it and depart to lead a life.
And those that know that this is real have been holding out for this time in ufological history when we all pack our bags and go away and get another life.
They hope.
They hope. That's a little depressing, knowing that Don Ecker is no longer going to be around, but we'll see how long that lasts.
Well, indeed, yes. The website UFO Digest carried an article just a few days ago titled, "Will the Reality of Extraterrestrial Life Shatter Religion?" An old subject that's been looked at many times in the past. And the author, John Miller, he spells his surname M-I-L-O-R, concludes, to be perfectly honest with you, I know not what, because as I got into the article, I gave up, because it was just starting to get full of biblical references and so on and so forth. So I actually don't know whether John Miller really believes that the reality of extraterrestrial life will shatter religion. Actually, sorry, I think he does. He sort of said so at the beginning and then went off into this sort of long biblical diatribe. I used to think the same, and I disagree now, having spoken to a number of people with religious positions, philosophers and so on. The general consensus seems to be that people aren't going to be too bothered from a religious point of view, and that somehow religion will work its way around it and adapt. I actually begin to think that it's a non-subject now, because if you do sit and ponder about what the impact of the reality of extraterrestrial life on the world, on the human population, might be, religion is one of those areas where your mind goes to, and I tend to think we've probably got it covered and we'll cope.
Certainly the Vatican has covered it off by saying that all beings, no matter where they're from, are children of God.
I think that the Vatican has actually hedged its bets very nicely, and I don't say that with cynicism, I say that in genuine admiration, actually. I think that they have taken steps to cover themselves should the event that we all want to happen. And to my knowledge, they're the only religion that's done that. And I wish them well with it. I think they've got on with it, really. And they've been prepared to talk about the subject. They've been prepared to spend a little bit of money on the subject. They've been prepared to allow senior priests within the church to go off and write papers on it and to study astronomy. Of course, the Vatican's got its own astronomy, telescopes and so on and so forth. I admire what they've done.
Well, they've certainly covered their tushies, haven't they?
Yes. I came across a very amusing piece the other day, which at first sight I thought was just a joke, but it seems it's not. But apparently the astronauts that went to the moon on their return had to go through U.S. customs, would you believe? I kid you not, Errol. There is documentation on behalf of Agricultural Customs, Immigration and Public Health Department, where a Mr. E. Aldwin, Jr. and a Mr. N. Armstrong have signed off on cargo brought back into the United States, including, inverted commas, moon rocks and moon dust.
And the U.S. government would tax the U.S. government on revenue on that. Not to be resold, yes.
There's been a very interesting development, actually, in the area to do with planetary exploration. And it's British or more specifically a Scottish discovery at the University of Glasgow. And this too does pose some questions about whether we will ever see ET with a head, two arms and two legs. Apparently, we are close to developing shape-shifting devices known as smart dust, which can be carried on the wind like dust particles and which can communicate with each other. They basically consist of a computer chip about a millimeter wide. They're surrounded by a polymer sheath. And these things can fly. They would wireless network amongst themselves to communicate with each other, and they would basically form a swarm. I don't know if they can travel large distances through space or whether they'd have to be carried, say, up into the atmosphere of a particular planet and then released. They could then set off and have a look. And so basically, if you were on the ground of one of these planets, you might be aware of or maybe could see what would appear to be a swarm of dust coming at you. And it just makes me think, well, if we're on the verge of building, constructing, and developing something like this, then perhaps intelligence elsewhere has done the same, if not even more sophisticated than this. And it does open in my mind again the question of, well, maybe intelligent life has been here, and we just haven't recognized it for what it is.
Which would give credence to the suggestion that the objects that we're seeing, the beings that we're seeing, are nothing but an initial contact awaiting acknowledgement of their existence.
To be perfectly honest, Errol, you can go anywhere with this.
Well, yes.
I've disturbed myself this time, you know. I mean, pretty well everything I've looked at has just posed more questions with no answers.
So what is the suggestion? That this cloud of superdust would be totally autonomous and sentient, able to think for itself?
I don't think it would be autonomous. I think there would be human control. But having said that, the way that microchip development is going, it could just be that they're programmed. Well, no, if they're programmed, then even if man isn't controlling it directly, they are indirectly controlled, because they'd be working to a software program. I'm not suggesting independent intelligence is built into these things. Not yet. In terms of the way it's described, they would operate on a circuitry, which presumably would be a program. And it would be a good way, for example, to take a further look at Venus or Mars. I mean, you know, particularly Venus is just totally inhospitable for the man. There's no way man's ever going to set foot on that planet.
Interesting.
Again, it poses questions. You know, well, if we're doing this, what was that swarm of midges I walked through, you know, an hour ago? Are they really midges or are they something else?
Mm-hmm. We are progress, aren't we? We're advancing very rapidly in fast forward mode as far as technology is concerned now.
Well, we are, Errol, actually, and it seems to have really picked up in recent years. I think it's touch and go, speaking personally, whether I'll still be on this planet when man finally sets foot on Mars. But I think it won't be that long, a matter of 5-6 years, possibly, before we know with a fair degree of certainty whether life exists on Mars, or rather confirmation of what we believe. I think we'll know well before man gets there whether life does exist on Mars or not.
Mm-hmm.
But whether I will actually still be alive to see man walking on the surface of Mars is something I'm not quite sure of. But we are, leaping ahead at the moment.
Very much so.
You and I, Errol, have had a number of private conversations recently about an individual who was a member of the UFO updates mailing list and then left under a bit of a cloud to retreat into the far dark corners of ufology. You're desperately trying as I speak now to remember
who it is,
Right. Well, I'll put you out of your agony. It was Rich Reynolds. But when we have had a couple of conversations about him over the last couple of months or so. I started off, I remember bringing him up and saying how I thought things had changed and that he was actually talking sense again. Because the trouble with Rich Reynolds was that he desperately, for reasons only he can explain, desperately wanted to be accepted into ufology as somebody of some, I don't know, what importance or whatever. And his manner and means by which he attempted to do this was so bizarre and so gauche that inevitably people turned on him very quickly and he was given short shrift. And I have to say, in all fairness, although I never had an axe to grind against him, but in all fairness, I can't blame people for the way that they've responded to him. He then started to snipe at people with personal attacks, and it all sort of culminated in that dreadful rubbish involving somebody on the list, and that was the final sort of straw that broke the camel's back for many people in terms of having any patience left for him. And off he went out into the wilderness, never to be heard of again. And then about a year or so ago, he started to blog again, and people just sort of ground their teeth and thought, you know, ignored him. The reason I am mentioning him is because I think for the last couple of months, easily, and possibly longer now, his has been one of the most interesting blogs going. With just one exception that I can think of in the last few months, he's dropped the chronic, pathetic personal attacks on people and is focusing on the subject and has come up, I think, with some pretty good stuff. And I'm actually rather tentatively going to say, because I think as soon as I say, well, maybe you should go and look at the blog, you can be guaranteed that Rich will probably put some rubbish up there, which is just abuse towards people within ufology or whatever. So I'm saying this tentatively. If you've not been and looked at his blog lately, it might be worth checking him out again. I do look at a lot of UFO blogs, and I think he's actually been doing some decent stuff. It's been challenging. It's been interesting. He's asked questions of all cases, and he's gone in certain directions. And some of it, he's come up against a brick wall fairly quickly, but it's interesting. In case you are at all interested, he's called UFO Iconoclasts. The URL is quite simple. It's ufocon.blogspot.com/. So ufocon, one word, .blogspot.com. I would say over the last few months, 95% of the stuff has been worth reading. And I mean worth reading from the point of view of being interesting and stimulating. 5%, he's reverted back to the ad hominem attacks on individuals, but it's been in the minority. I have to say that there is a strong skeptical lean, just in general tone and philosophy, to the blog. So, you know, you need to be prepared for that. There's definitely a skeptical bent there. But I also think that a lot of what he's written has been worthwhile. And it's had merit. It's at least been worth reading, even if you get to the end of it and think, no, this is rubbish. But it's at least been worth reading.
Well, good. And I won't ask you to repeat the URL again, because people can just rewind and play it for themselves again. One of the joys of listening to this as a recording, rather than streaming online or over the air. Not that you haven't come up with some pretty breathtaking stuff this time, Stuart Miller, but have we pretty much covered everything off?
We have, yes.
I think that's all my old heart can take. And several times you have left me short of breath, which you haven't heard because I've had my mic shut off. But it's always fascinating to have you on the program, Stuart. It's really good to have you out there and gathering this material that you can report every month, and always thought-provoking. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure.
And we shall talk again in about 4 weeks.
Okay, I look forward to it.
Me too. Thanks, Stuart. That's Stuart Miller, our British correspondent, who publishes the fascinating UFO review, which you can download as a PDF or as a doc file. Always puts news up there that is fascinating on a daily basis. UFOreview.net. Go look at it.
Nothing's gonna change my world. Nothing's gonna change my world.
Jeremy Vaney is an award-winning writer and insight columnist for UFO Magazine. His website describes him as a complete media whore who works in TV and film. And he'll be coming to a movie theater near you soon in a documentary about his life as an abductee. Jeremy Vaney wanted to know why aliens don't just land on the White House lawn and announce themselves to the world. So he did the one thing that no one else has done. And his new book, I Know Why the Aliens Don't Land,
pretty much says it all, I think.
And that's, I guess, for a lot of people, is a very strange thing to do. But then a lot of the people listening have not had the experience that Jeremy Vaney has had, or the experiences. Joining us on the line from his home in New York City is author Jeremy Vaney. Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
How did you get to ask them why they don't land?
Well, I don't know that I literally ask them why they don't land. I've just sort of been piecing it together. And I think I pretty much have figured it out.
There are usually two types of people who've had interaction with what we consider to be aliens. There are the experiencers, who, for the most part, have been quite happy with their interaction. And then there are the abductees. Which category would you say you fall into?
I always have called myself an abductee, just probably because it's the first word that I had known to associate that with this. But, you know, I hate to be on the fence about this, but I think it's neither here nor there.
Ah, well, there is definitely a fence there by the sound of it. When was your first experience?
Arguably, my first experience was when I was about 3 years old. And this is just from going back and asking my family, hey, do you remember anything weird? And then my dad telling me the story of basically waking up in the middle of the night and feeling as though there was somebody in the house. And then he heard me screaming from my bedroom. So he ran in to see what was wrong. And I was standing up in my bed and pointing at the corner of the ceiling and yelling, Daddy, make it go away, make it go away. And he said he felt like somebody moved behind him. And he turned around, and there was no one there. And he immediately felt as though whatever it was had left the place. And I just lay back down and went to sleep. So there's that. But the first time I actually saw them and can say, yeah, definitely this, was when I was 15. And something walked into my room. And it was babbling at me. And I couldn't make out facial detail or anything like that because it was dark in my room. But I could see that it had something sort of long and sharp in its left hand. And I could see its head bobbing as it was talking to me and could physically hear its voice. I mean, I wouldn't say it was a telepathic message. The thing that had woke me up was hearing my bedroom door open because it makes this sort of thump sound. So that woke me up and I sort of sat upright in bed and watched this thing walk in. I actually said out loud, Ma, what are you doing? Why are you in my room? Go back to bed. And then immediately thought, this isn't your mother. You know what this is. And my mother was the only other person in the house at the time. And fight or flight instinct kicked in and I pulled the covers over my head. I was scared out of my mind and that's all I remember of that. And I'd asked my mother the next morning if she'd come into my room, and of course, the answer was no.
What sort of description would you give the being that you saw?
Well, that time, I would just say, I don't know. It was a shadowy being, you know, because it was dark in my room, like I said. I couldn't really make anything out. See, this is interesting to me because, you know, one of the arguments skeptics like to use is that we see this stuff in the media, and so, you know, we invent these things. But you'd think that a high school kid, having been exposed to all this stuff, would have in fact seen the little gray guys or whatever. But that just hadn't been the case up until 99 or 2000. But then most definitely in October 2001, when they were right there, you know, and there was no mistaking it. And sure enough, they are in fact little gray guys with big eyes. I mean, the description is not wrong. But it's interesting, having seen them now, because human beings have the ability to tell factual image from fiction. So, for instance, like with computer-generated images, if you're watching Jurassic Park and you see a dinosaur, it looks totally real because we have no reference point for a dinosaur.
Yes.
But if you watch something like Jumanji or something where the special effect is an animal you've seen or a human being, you can immediately distinguish that that's not real because you've seen those things and your eye picks up on subtle movements of computer-generated image versus real life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having seen these aliens, previous to actually having them right there and getting the full detail, I could watch these TV shows with aliens in them, or movies, and just like the average person, I'd say, oh, yeah, well, that must be what an alien looks like. But now, having actually seen them, I look at this stuff and I'm like, no, that's, even on their best day, that doesn't begin to capture the real life fullness of these things.
That final revelation, I guess, to you in 2001 must have been fairly freaky, I would think.
Well, it was even freakier than fairly freaky because it was sort of a two-parter. Mm. I mean, I didn't want to believe it when it happened. The thing that happened was I was in another bedroom in the same apartment, and my mattress was on the floor, and I had a girlfriend at the time who was sleeping next to me, and I had light coming in through my window is what woke me up. So I woke up and sort of perched up on my elbow, and I'm trying to look out the window and see what the source of this thing is, because it was really bright, but it was sort of diffuse lighting, sort of foggy in a way. And girlfriend's out. She's not waking up to this. So I'm like, all right, whatever. So I roll over, and there on the side of my bed are three gray aliens wearing, I feel stupid saying this every time I say it, but were wearing some sort of hooded garment, just staring at me, you know, just standing there. And immediately when that happened, it was just this deep down terror. And it's two things at the same time. This is why I'm saying abductee and experience are sort of neither here nor there.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the same time that I'm feeling this absolute animal terror, which I would say, I don't know if you've read or heard of Whitley Strieber's book, The Grays. You know, it's a work of fiction, but some of it's not. And he describes the experience as perhaps being almost an allergy, almost this fear being an allergic reaction to these beings. It's just something in the cellular level that produces this agonizing terror.
Mm.
And I would say that that is absolutely true, because at the same time that I have this undescribable terror, at the exact same time, I'm also sensing from them that they're playful or naive, or there's something in that realm of emotion coming from them that is just sort of nice. And so I'm thinking, looking back on it, that really the terror is my own.
They being nice, perhaps, was something that they were projecting?
They weren't projecting it in a way that, like, come trust us and like us. I mean, they were projecting it in the normal way that a person, you know, if you just see somebody sort of half smiling at you, you just pick up on body language like that. And then the next thing I know, and it, you know, dreamlike in that sense, in that I don't have any memory of how I got there, but the next thing I know, I'm still in the same underwear that I went to bed in. I'm standing up in this nondescript room, dark, with some unseen light source coming down from above, illuminating this row of tables, horizontal from my view, and on the tables are naked people, naked humans. And they're out cold, they're unconscious, and the one closest to me is this blonde, maybe late 40s, early 50s female, and the beings are standing around her and sort of looking at me as if to say, yep, this is what we do, you know, kind of like show and tell or something. And I'm sedate. Now I'm fine. I'm not at all in any sort of terror for whatever reason. And I'm thinking, why am I seeing this? And a female voice that I hear often associated with these sort of experiences says, because you've always wanted to remember an abduction.
Oh.
I thought that was amazing. And I remember remembering, if that makes sense, a whole lot, but I let it go, because the next day I figured, this can't happen. I mean, I live in New York. There couldn't have been something outside creating a light source coming in through my window. This just couldn't possibly have happened. So I just let it go. I jotted it down, but even though I knew it wasn't a dream, I just wanted it to be. That's just where you want to put these things. But maybe it was a year later or so, we had this subletting roommate, Brian, here. Well, see, now this is going to be an interesting story, because there's another thing about me that around the year 2000 started, I don't want to say I started meditating, I sort of cleared my mind for the sake of clearing my mind for the first time ever, and when I did that, this energy came into my body, or welled up in my body, however you want to describe it, and started doing odd body movements, which slowly turned into like yoga and tai chi, just things that look like that. That's just the preamble for this. So I woke up again, this is like a year or so later, because it was light in my room. And now I had switched bedrooms, and I'm in the room that I'm in now. So I'm looking out the window, and it's dark out. And this is confusing to me, because it's bright in my room, and it's dark out. And I, once again, roll over, and where my wall should be is the same bright, diffuse light that had come in through my window, you know, in 2001. It's a force field or something. You know, like, where my wall should be was just this bright white light. I could feel that I had a bloody nose going on as I'm looking at this, but it was running down the back of my throat. It wasn't running out of my nose. And I think the reason is because earlier in the night, this energy, which does all of these Tai Chi odd things, was sort of welling up and wanting to do whatever it wanted to do. So I let it do whatever it wanted to do, and it ended up pinching the bridge of my nose. So I think it knew what was going to happen that night and cauterized my nose in some way that I wouldn't bleed all over the place when it happened. And when I woke up in the morning, and I was forgotten all of whatever had happened during the night, but then when I was talking to the subletting roommate, Brian, my nose started bleeding, and then that triggered the memory, and I went, oh my God. And then remembering that same light made me realize that the first experience was absolutely true and not a dream, because I was totally awake for this.
So you have two conscious recollections of things going on. What prompted you to think at some point, I want to remember my abduction? Were you aware that you'd been taken or that you'd had interaction with these beings?
The thing that woke me up to all of this happened when I was 13, which was driving to my grandparents from Massachusetts to Vermont and seeing what was clearly a ship. It wasn't no swamp gas. And it was the stereotypical deserted road, middle of the night scenario. And my mother and I both saw it. My sister was on the trip as well, but I don't know if it was because she was in the passenger seat and the thing was at an angle where she couldn't see it on the driver's side, or if she just was not interested and wasn't looking. But in any event, my mother and I both saw this oval or round-shaped fluorescent green self-luminescent porthole windows running down the middle, red and blue blinking lights, the top half spinning one way, the bottom half spinning the other, and just sort of sitting in the air, tilted on its axis, doing this. Silently, from what I could tell, brief second, I rolled down my window. And we got to our grandparents' house, told them what we had seen, thinking they were going to laugh at us. And like clockwork, no, it turns out they had Time Life Mysteries of the Unexplained on the coffee table. And, oh, wouldn't you know, our uncle had had this UFO experience a while back, and so now he's sort of looking into it. And all of that, to me, at least at 13, I don't know that this is objectively the fact, but it just felt like such a weird coincidence that it felt planned. Like, that was sort of my first introduction to synchronicity or something along those lines. So from then on, it was just like, okay, what's going on? And then between then and 15, I had these sort of flashback dreams. You know, they were dreams, but they were the first time that I'd ever had dreams that were in the first person. And they were just snippets of things that smacked of abduction, something taking me out of the house. Sort of realistic in that there's something taking me from behind, pulling me out of the house, pulling me through the living room, and I can't really move, and I'm trying to grab this picture on the wall that I was trying to grab to bring into it, because I remembered reading, I think it was Transformation, where Willie Strieber brought his cat to an abduction with him because he wanted something real so he'd know it was real. So I was grabbing for this picture, remembering that, trying to bring this with me, and I couldn't get it. So, you know, weird things like that. And then at 15, you know, the thing walked into my room.
It boggles my mind when I hear descriptions like yours of experiences like yours. Because these experiences have been going on for so very long in our history and have been ascribed to the hag syndrome or hypnagogic paralysis. So that's what it was ascribed to in the past. And then you get the abductees who are now in their late 50s, early 60s, who've been taken since they were kids. And back when they were kids, and on an ongoing basis, they've been through these experiences. But you can't, as the skeptics try to point out, well, they must have seen it on television or in the movies, because in reality, with some of the early abductees that we know about, there weren't documentaries. There wasn't that stuff on TV until the Betty and Barney Hill story in the late 60s.
Yeah. Wasn't really even about that until the mid-80s, because the early 80s, remember, it was all about, like, Condor and Falcon, you know, telling us what, you know, aliens eat strawberry ice cream, and it was all about shady government dealings and stuff like that. That was sort of what the TV was occupied with. But I feel like I'm lucky in a way, just in who I am and things that I've experienced, in that I think I'm overly imaginative, so I can check that off the list. And and I've also had one of those waking dreams, so I can check that off the list, you know?
Yeah.
I absolutely know what the difference is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, for instance, the waking dream was, I think it was in college when I had it, a dream that my mother came in to tuck me in the morning while she was going off to work. And it was clearly my mother walking into my room, you know? It wasn't some shady figure, it was my mom. She came and sat down on the bed and did all this. As it's playing out, I'm thinking, this is not real. This is not at all real. This is not real. The total opposite of an abduction, which is, I want it to be that, and no, you know what this is, deal with it. It's not your mom. I don't know. I wish these researchers would actually, Robert Persinger who does the...
Michael Persinger, yes.
Michael Persinger does the temporal lobe work. Did any of these researchers do it to themselves? You can tell there's a qualitative difference between the reality of it and the stuff they're saying that it is. It just is not that. It just always seems like such a false positive to say, well, we can stimulate your brain to make you feel as though people are in the room, and that answers abductions, you know? Well, does that also answer when I'm in a room full of people? You know?
Yes. I haven't personally experienced the helmet, but I've seen several reports on Daily Planet, which is Discovery Channel Canada's daily science program, and the host of that being subjected to Persinger's helmet and saying, yeah, I did sort of bottom of my line of vision, I could see these little white, almost alien-like figures. But that doesn't explain walking down the street and suddenly realize that you're going to be taken again and running terrified.
Right.
And then waking up on the doorstep an hour later, or driving along in a car, and you're headed for wherever it is, and you're about 30 or 40 miles from your destination, and you see this object, and suddenly you're on the highway headed in the wrong direction, 70 miles from your destination.
Right, right. It doesn't explain the entire laundry list of things that make this a real event. The other interesting thing while we're on the debunking the debunkers is hypnosis. Of course, I'm not a psychologist, so I don't really know, but hypnosis, it's possible to suggest all of these things to somebody who's under hypnosis and
yes,
make them see what they want. But wouldn't the narrative that the average person comes up with be nonsensical? Wouldn't it be more dreamlike if they were, in fact, making it up to please somebody?
Yes.
It would still be less of a smacking of a real-life narrative. Eventually, something silly or just plain nonsense would come out of their mouths,
yes,
you would think.
And that's an interesting point, and I don't think I've heard it pointed out before. Good one, Jeremy. Yeah. See, they're still giving you input. You mentioned your uncle who was into UFOs and aliens and abductions, and your sister who didn't see it at all, and she was on the passenger seat. Were you sitting behind your mother who was presumably driving? Okay, so it might have been on your side of the vehicle. And the reason that I bring that up is that it seems to me, as Dr. David Jacobs has said many times, that this is transgenerational, and it happens to all members of families. And many of those members are in denial about it completely.
Yeah, I would say that's certainly true. It's interesting. I did actually have a DVD that I premiered last year, and it's coming out in May. And it's basically, the first half of it is me asking my friends and family, basically, what do you think about all the stuff that I claim? Because I feel like we've seen enough documentaries on abductees and haven't really gotten into, hey, you know, what do the people around these guys think, you know?
Yeah.
And it's funny because people who are skeptics or just plain not, quote unquote, believers walk away thinking that my family has validated that I'm insane or that they don't believe me or whatever. But the believers and certainly the abductees walk away thinking that this is definitely a family in denial. And it's really interesting because you hear them actually say, for instance, my mother say, yes, I saw this UFO, and she describes it. I don't describe it. She describes it. And my sister agreeing, you know, I talk about this time she saw a UFO come down out of the sky and some small probe comes out of the bottom of it, goes out about 15 feet, goes back into the UFO, and the UFO shoots straight up. And this is when we were, well, she's 3 years older than me, but when I was about 8 or 9, I remember her and her best friend, like, running over to me and my friend in the street, yammering about they had just seen this thing and just exasperated. We'd talked about it over the years. So here she is agreeing, begrudgingly, that she saw this thing, but she's saying that she thinks she was messing with us because by calling it a UFO. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's the description of a UFO. But she just can't even make that leap. And she's someone who also has told me she can't wear watches because they stop working.
And that's another indicator from
exactly
what I can gather, yes.
So you put the pieces together, and to people in the know, that's what it looks like. It looks like family in denial. But to everybody else, it looks like, see, they're telling you it's not real. It's just strange.
And your sister has no memories of being taken herself, or your mother?
No, not my mother either. My father has a weird memory, which I say is a screen memory. I don't really know that, but sounds like it, of driving again in New Hampshire, again Dustler Road, at around, you know, midnight or so, and seeing, driving by and trying to drive around, this long bike with a bunch of small, bald people on it with weird troll-like faces. Now, this is his description, and he said, you know, he looked at and he tried not to hit them, obviously, and looked at them in the rearview mirror to make sure he wasn't just hallucinating or tired, and there they were, and he didn't know what to make of that. But I would say that's a screen memory for something.
Yes, yes. But describing them as he did, it's not totally screen, because there's a similar description of
those beings as well. Bald-headed guys looking like trolls. Several of them, you said, riding on a bicycle?
Yeah.
It's amazing that you, on the one hand, can recall a lot of this, and your sister, whom it seems the indicators would suggest that she's been taken to, has no memory of it at all. Is it possible that were she to recall what it was that she had experienced would totally just freak her out and maybe push her over an edge that she doesn't need to be pushed over?
Yeah, I would say that's probably true of, well, maybe all three of them, certainly my mother and sister.
Mm-hmm.
I think my father's a little more open to the possibility, but none of them want to seek any, you know, first of all, they don't believe it, so they're not going to seek counseling, but I don't think they would anyway.
Yes. You know? Are there any more uncles in your family other than the one that you mentioned?
Yep, but I haven't spoken with them about it at all.
That would be
interesting. I mean, I don't let, you know, it's funny, I write for UFO Magazine, I write books, I do movies, but I rarely, I mean, I don't speak about it with my extended family, including my uncle, with the exception of us sort of trading the UFO stories. But as far as I know, none of them know about any of this stuff, you know, mm-hmm. book, movie, all that stuff.
You mentioned the DVD. Is that going to be available on your website, Valians? I like that, valians.com, aliens with a V on the beginning, valians.com. Will people be able to go see clips from it, or will they be able to download it, or will they be able to buy it?
You can download a trailer there, certainly, and there's a link to Amazon. Right now I'm selling it on Amazon.com.
It's out there already?
Yeah, it's available for pre-order, yeah.
And all produced by yourself, huh?
Yep.
I would like to get myself a copy of that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about it,
because mm-hmm.
it's certainly not a straightforward documentary at all. Mm-hmm. And here's something funny. I had a DVD launch party last Wednesday, and we did a Q&A afterward, and one of the women was in the audience wasn't a huge fan of some of the stuff I did, and I don't want to spoil it by telling you what it is, but I play some tricks on the audience. How about that?
Okay.
Which I own up to in the movie, so it's not like a huge lie. But anyway, she wasn't a fan of that, and then she started sort of arguing with me points that I was making in the Q&A about Bud Hopkins' work, where I sort of think he goes right, certainly, but where he also falls short, and how some of what he's saying, I feel like, backs up what I'm saying more than what he's saying, in a way. So she's arguing this stuff with me, and it turns out it was Carol Rainey.
Oh, really?
Yeah. His compadre and co-author of Sight Unseen.
Yes.
So I thought that was very interesting.
Although they are not a couple anymore.
Yeah, well, she made that clear to me, too.
Have you actually talked to Bud Hopkins or Dave Jacobs?
No, but in June, I'm throwing together a festival in New York, an alien abductee empowerment, almost, a film and arts festival with fellow abductees. So I've spoken with them in that I've asked them to come speak, and if Jacobs can clear his schedule, he's going to, but Bud Hopkins is definitely going to speak, and so is Carol Rainey. I actually won her back over after the Q&A, and she's going to show a short film and speak. So on that level, I've spoken with them, but not about my own stuff.
This gathering that you're having is in June in New York?
Yeah, we're basically sort of taking over the East Village in New York, and we're going to show movies at the Pioneer Movie Theater, and we're taking over a school for the weekend, and setting it up as an art gallery, and going to have guest speakers on Sunday, June 22nd, 23rd, 24th. And we're going to do an alien rock and roll nighttime thing with Michael Luckman speaking, and it should be a lot of fun. I don't know. Hope it works out.
Well, I'm sure it will, and you'll probably find that the timing is absolutely perfect, because I don't think there has been anything done in the last few years in New York other than Bud Hopkins' organization running their seminars a couple of three times a year.
Yeah, there's really nothing for the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told over and over again, oh, this will never work, it's just too big to be able to do. But so far, it's come together fairly easily and organically. I mean, speakers aren't even asking to be paid. The spaces are relatively cheap. It's really easy to put together. And so with the proper advertising, it should be pretty good.
I'm sure it will be. Let's come back and talk about the way I introduced you. The book is I Know Why the Aliens Don't Land. And then you said, well, you actually really don't, but you think you managed to figure it out.
Yeah.
So why don't the aliens land, Jeremy Vaney?
They don't land because this is going to sound new agey and it may be weird. But I'm just going to say it anyway because I think it's actually the case, which is that they actually live life through the point of view of oneness, and humans live life through the point of view of separation. and separation is an illusion, and oneness is actually the truth of the matter. So for them to come here and try to engage us would be to engage our illusion. And to explain it to us, like I'm sort of doing now, it would make logical sense, but it wouldn't actually wake us up in the way that they need to. And so, and actually this is the point I was making to Carol Rainey about her own book, Sight Unseen, that supports this, which is that rather than speak to us consciously, work at us on unconscious levels, you know, they sort of poke and prod us in abstract ways that speak to us on another level, because they're just not going to deal with us consciously.
So what is the point of taking people like yourself and the many others who've been through that?
What is the point of taking us? I can't speak to what every little experiment and all of that is.
I hoped you had an answer.
The general overarching problem here is that we're not at all at the same level, and we're trying to pull them down to our level, and it's just not going to work that way. And it's funny, because on our best day, we're pretty rational beings, and so this is something that transcends rationality, but because we don't have a reference point for it, we tend to lump it in with the irrational and with belief systems, insanity, psychological dysfunctions, things like that, and it's just not any of those things. So that's the problem with trying to speak to logical beings about something that's translogical.
It still doesn't answer the question, though.
Well, which question? Of why they don't land?
No. Why is it that they have to put people through basically terrifying experiences for most of them?
I don't know that that's happening, I guess, is my point. Because, like I said, I mean, I think the fear is ours. I think the fear is our own. I don't think it's inherent to the situation. I think that that whole fear thing, again, the Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs of the world, it's not their fault that they say that all of this is evil or malevolent aliens or whatever, because they see people who are terrorized, right? And these people come to them and they're terrorized for years and years and years,
yeah.
And then something happens. They come out of it.
Not
all
of them.
They're on another side of it. And then what do they say? They say, well, Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs, they say, well, that's just the aliens making you feel that way, or that's Stockholm Syndrome, where you're identifying with the abuser.
Mm.
And why wouldn't they? Because previously, these people were terrified. But I feel like it is a stage that you go through and you get over.
I know of several abductees who would just totally disagree with you on that. And they live in horror and dread of it happening to them again. And are hugely indignant that they're being taken against their will. And where does free will fit into it all is another question that arises.
Well, I don't even see free will as a thing. Free will to me is there's one free will choice, and that is to live the point of view of oneness or live the point of view of separation. That's our free will choice. Any choice made from the point of view of separation is going to be faulty. It's going to be a wrong choice. But I would say to those people that you're talking about, it's interesting because it sounds like what you're saying implies a whole different take on experiencing the experience. Like, I'm fascinated by it, you know? Even though I'm scared out of my mind when it's happening, I'm still consciously fascinated by it. You know, what is this? And it sounds like, from what you're saying, that these guys just don't want anything to do with it and are just sort of blocking it out and putting up a fight. I guess I'm just saying if you stop putting up the fight, it becomes more than what it is.
I've also heard a lot of people, such as Will Boucher, who worked with Dr. John Mack. He was in the program two programs ago, say mostly the same thing that you have. Initially, he was terrified. Eventually, he became a pragmatist about it. Jeremy Vainey, I want to thank you a lot for doing this with us. Valians.com is your website. The book is I Know Why the Aliens Don't Land. And that's Valians with a V-A-L-I-E-N-S. Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, thank you for having me. And if you have questions, I'll come back on. We'll do it again. Bye-bye.
Man that I've had a great deal of love and respect for is John Velez. John has been involved with the UFO Updates List from its very inception. He and I met many, many years ago in Toronto when he and Bud Hopkins were up here doing a TV talk show, which was despicable, I think is the way to describe that.
John has been in and out of our lives over the last couple of years, and maybe even in and out of his own life, but now he's back in. Welcome back to the program, John Velez, Abductee Advocate.
It's good to be back. It's always great to spend time with you.
You have been on the move somewhat of late, huh?
Yeah, interstate moves and change of life moves. And I mean, everything at a time of life when most people are looking for stability, to enjoy a little stability, I've had a complete and total changeover. I've changed geographic location. Every aspect of my life has changed. And for the better, I might add. I'm very happy and settled in my new location and looking forward to spending more time with you.
I'm certainly looking forward to it. And now that you're telephonically connected, it's going to make life much easier. I am puzzled, and I know you are, as to why people in general, when they get into even talking about abductions or writing about abductions, tend to focus more on what the scientists are saying. You know, it's false memory syndrome, yada, 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 dreams, whatever it is that they cop out with.
It's a difficult topic. We've discussed it many times, how difficult it is for anyone to wrap their mind around the concept to begin with. And the fact that the academic community is looking for quick and easy answers in order to dismiss it, they don't take it seriously to begin with. But the few in academia that have tackled the subject have approached it, I think, with a very obvious bias on the front end and kind of, you know, elicited the results that they were looking for to begin with and managed to only to support, you know, their own theories or takes on the phenomena rather than doing any genuine a hard science based on research and testing and the accepted scientific methods that can be employed when investigating any subject. They kind of been chasing their tails for a lot of years. It's still the whole phenomena and the subject is still stuck there in the talk stages. The simple fact that so many thousands of honest ordinary people from all around the world have reported the exact same phenomena, and by the exact same phenomena, I mean the same involving UFOs, involving non-human beings, involving interactions with these beings, that some form of contact has taken place. I think that we all need to acknowledge that at some point, you can't dismiss that many thousands of human beings. And I'm talking about people from all walks of life, credible people, professional, honest people who have established their own integrity and honesty and credibility that are reporting these experiences. You can't dismiss them all. And even if you're only left with a small handful at the end of an elimination process where you're only left with the most credible people and reports, you still have a really solid core of data there that indicates that something major is going on, that something real is going on, something substantial. There are so many physical aspects to the phenomena that have always consistently been ignored. And I don't see any progress being made in terms of expanding the scope of the research or doing any research at all. And I don't think that's going to happen anytime in the near future either. And that's a bit of a daunting and disappointing turn of events, but that's what it's turned out to be. Ufology isn't what it used to be. It's not research-oriented anymore. It's more of a public open rap forum, and I don't think very much serious work is being done anymore, with the exception of a few groups like Jan Aldrich and Project 1947, and, you know, certain individuals that always approach the subject with intelligence and sobriety, Jerry Clark, Dick Hall, small handful of people.
It seems to me that the science is being used to explain abductions that only, as far as the scientists are concerned, happens at night and in bed.
Exactly. It's a sweeping it under the rug, Errol. Again, it's a tough subject to wrap your mind around. Most scientists don't acknowledge that UFOs exist, much less occupants that are interacting with humanity.
And all of the daytime abductions, as I'd said earlier in the program, off a highway, the experience that you had walking home one night.
Yeah, in people's homes while you're cooking dinner. Look at the Debbie Jordan case. There's a ton of that material, and that gets completely ignored. And those are the cases that usually have the strongest physical evidence attached to them. The Debbie Jordan case, again, is a classic in that regard in terms of the ground trace evidence. The family pet died as a result of this encounter from what all appearances was radiation sickness. I mean, this animal lost its fur, developed lesions, fevers, lost the pigmentation in the eyes and went blind. And I mean, all of the signs of radiation sickness.
Cash Landrum case, yes, where one of them died of radiation.
Yeah. None of that is ever dealt with by the academics for some reason. They prefer to deal with the easy cases, like as they do with the UFO cases. This is historical, Errol. They're following the same pattern it's followed the last 50 years. They debunk the easy cases and hold those up to the public and say, oh, see, it was only weather balloons, or this was only a temperature anomaly or a weather inversion, or it was a this or it was a that. And they always like to go public with the more easily explained cases because it allows them to dismiss the whole subject. And at the same time, a huge chunk of humanity, a segment of the population.
As you say, it's been going on for half a century now.
More, according to Dave Jacobs and Bud Hopkins, they have reports of cases that go back very close to the turn of the century. In fact, David Jacobs ties the abduction phenomena to the airship wave sightings of the 1890s. Mm-hmm. In 1894, 95, 96, there was this wave of airship sightings all over America. And Jacobs ties that to the coming, he says that's his Roswell, that's when he thinks the abduction phenomena started, was in conjunction with those massive airship sightings that were taking place at the turn of the century.
When I said it's been going on for 50 years, my inference was the last 50 years where science has been poo-pooing abduction.
Yeah. No one acknowledged that there may have been an interior to UFOs until the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
Up until then, they were these flying objects. Then the Betty and Barney Hill shape introduced occupants, the UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
It's been an evolutionary process. Something major is going on, and it's a communication process that I think we're only just beginning to comprehend and understand. One of the things that's kind of bothered me about how the phenomena is related to and treated is this business of splitting the abductees into general groups, like saying that, there are abductees and there are experiences, there are the new agees and there are the people that are bitching and griping because they've been violated and all of that. And I think, that's an oversimplified and simplistic kind of an approach and attitude to take towards it all. Because, you're dealing with a human population and there's going to be as much variety as there are individuals in the group. And I think that it's not so important to nitpick categories and people's take on the phenomena as much as focusing on the phenomena itself as a phenomenon. What's blatantly obvious is that a contact has been made, that first contact has happened. A done deal. And now we need to look at what that means and what it means for us and what we need to do in order to prepare to communicate maybe or to acknowledge the contact. We have yet to acknowledge the contact. The individuals involved have, I have, I haven't tried to slap my own interpretations on the phenomenon itself. I have been very vocal about my feelings, my personal feelings about it, how I personally felt violated by it on many levels. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that I was the head of a family. I had a wife and children that I was responsible for, and I felt responsible for their well-being, for protecting them, for keeping them from harm, as well as being a good provider for them and, you know, making sure they had a roof over their head and clothes on their back and food in their bellies. A huge component of that, as any parent will testify to, is a feeling of protectiveness towards your offspring and towards your spouse, towards your wife,
yes,
towards your family, and that a lot of my sense of indignity of it all and the violation of it all came from that aspect of the phenomena, which happens to be very emasculating. The fact that these beings can initiate contact whenever they wish, regardless of what's going on in your life or your consciousness or your world, they kind of intrude on your reality in that way. Mm. And I'm not slapping any judgments on whether that's good, bad, or indifferent, whether it's for our benefit or not, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Just looking at it as a man, as a human being, as a father, as a husband, I said, holy moly, something's violating the sanctity of my home.
Mm-hmm.
That these things, this force, this entity, this agency, whatever this is, has interacted with my children and with my wife. And independently of me or of my feelings about it, that I was not consulted, I was not asked for my consent, no one knocked on my door and asked if they could come into my home. I mean, none of those simple human conventions were acknowledged in any way, shape, or form, which I guess only goes to emphasize how alien the other side of this equation is. But that's where those feelings come from. It's not in terms of my passing a judgment on the phenomenon, what it means, or whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know. I don't think any of us do. But what we haven't been doing, and what I think is important that we start doing, is thinking seriously about how we are going to respond to this initial contact from something that is not us, that is not human, that may not even be of this dimension, of this universe, that could be from some parallel universe for all we know. But at some point, we all need to put our heads together and acknowledge the fact that a contact is happening, has happened, and is continuing to happen. And we got to wake up and figure out how to respond to it.
Absolutely. The response is not going to be forthcoming very quickly.
No, it's going to take a major event, Daryl. It really will take a landing on the White House lawn or a UFO parked over the Empire State Building or some dramatic, very public and unavoidable kind of an event to bring humanity to a true awareness of the importance, how big this is and what a milestone it is for humanity. It's going to take something major. I don't think it'll happen of its own volition or even through any of our efforts.
It's going to be, hey, Earthlings, pay attention.
Yeah. And I don't know that they would do that kind of thing, because there's something as blatant as the phenomenon is in terms of how it presents itself at times and it's under certain conditions. There's also something very enigmatic and mysterious about it, and kind of we're dealing with something very large and far removed from anything familiar to us. And how do you build a bridge between where you are and that is? And I think that the phenomena itself is the communication process from their side. They have initiated the contact. They made contact. It's up to us now to acknowledge that that contact has happened and to find a way to respond to it.
If Frank Fascino's work over the last few years for his book, Shoot 'Em Down, is any indicator, then back in the 1950s, well, 1952 almost specifically, when there were those objects over the Capitol in Washington, D.C., if the response has been, let's shoot these things down, then the response is not particularly positive on our part.
You know, since the Reagan comments in the 80s...
I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us? What could be more alien to the universal aspirations of our peoples than war and the threat of war?
That remark in and of itself, as astounding as it was, is also very revealing. And if taken at face value, apparently, if this is a real phenomenon and they acknowledge it and they're aware of it and they know about it, they see it as a threat. And I'm not surprised that they've tried to shoot them down and fire weapons at them or do whatever it is they try to do to bring them down. I don't even doubt that they've been successful at bringing them down on occasion and that they have some physical hardware tucked away somewhere in like a Area 51 or Wright Pat or, you know, one of those Air Force bases.
Yes.
Where they're actually working with this material. But I think that what we're dealing with, the alien force or entity or whatever this is so far advanced of where we are right now in terms of evolution that they're able to absorb even our initial hostile acts. Even if we killed some of them, there's something almost Buddhist about the fact that there hasn't been a major retaliation to that kind of action on our part.
Mm.
If we were dealing with a force that was on a par with us in terms of our evolution, then there would have been an immediate retaliation to our attacks on their craft, on their people. That's not the case, though. That hasn't happened. We haven't been invaded. Military bases haven't been blown up, but what has happened is UFOs have visited them, have shut down whole missile systems, and let them know in no uncertain terms. That's a very clear message that we can turn these things off anytime we want to.
Yeah.
You know, so go on ahead and fire them at each other, but if we choose to turn them off, we have the technology to do it. The messages from them have been very clear all along. There has been some violence reported in regard to UFOs. The kid in Australia, Errol, that disappeared in his airplane some 20 years ago, Valentic, young pilot, experienced, disappears while reporting a UFO is approaching him and chasing him in the air.
Mm-hmm.
There are cases where there have been questionable events involving UFOs and UFO occupants, but then we may not have all the facts on those stories. We don't know who fired on who first or exactly what transpired that led up to those kinds of responses. But overall, in general, the UFOs and the UFO occupants have not retaliated directly for any attacks on their craft or their people and have not invaded the Earth or taken any kind of, you know, hostile action towards us.
Mm-hmm.
Even the abductions indicate more of a scientific mission than a malevolent military one. It smacks more of scientists at work, biologists, whatever sciences of theirs are involved. It sounds more like that kind of contact or an investigation than it doesn't sound like anything hostile, threatening, or military.
It's so puzzling, it's so frustrating, both in regard to the objects themselves, their occupants, and in this planet's reaction to them. yeah. puzzling and mystifying.
Oh, it's an ostrich. We've stuck our heads in this. We've buried our heads in the sand. Nobody's acknowledging it. You know what it is? I'm terribly frustrated on two fronts. One, I agree with Dick Hall. I don't think there's enough serious research going on anymore. I don't think there are enough of the right people. I don't think there are enough good people involved in doing honest, serious research into this subject. And the other, the flip side of the coin is I think it's time we get past all of this is it happening talk and start seriously communicating with each other about what it means and how do we respond to this. Because having our heads buried in the sand and debunking and knocking down every UFO report or abduction report or report of alien contact of any kind that comes along, how long do we ignore the knock at the door? Can we afford to?
Well, yeah, but at the same time, can we afford to open the door up?
Yeah, that's, well, you know, at some point we all have to make some kind of a collective decision, but I don't see that happening.
Oh, we're far too preoccupied with our tribal warfare here and, you know, living day-to-day life.
Yeah, and in the meantime, miracles continue to happen all around us.
And seemingly magical things, too.
Yes.
Yes. And that's a whole other radio series.
Yes, it is.
You know, and I'd love to be able to do that, as I have done in the past. I guess we really do need to stick to what it is that this program is about.
You got to remember, regardless of what conditions you're doing it under, you're the only one doing it.
Well, I'm not, but I think I'm the only one who's doing it this way.
Yeah.
Not even the big network show. I don't think any of the other podcasts are doing it quite the way that I do it.
I meant what I said. Earl, no one is doing it the way you do it. I can't think of another program that covers the latest sightings and whatever's coming out in terms of research or cases, and it literally is UFO updates. Nobody else does that, and nobody else does it as well as you do.
Well, thank you, kindly.
It's always very current. Yeah, no, yeah, I mean, credit where credit is due.
What's the point of rehashing old cases? Although, yeah, we do it here on occasion, too.
Yeah.
But when there's so much new stuff going on, and it's the same with the updates list and other email lists, you know, they're very happy to just keep on talking about the same old, same old.
Yep.
And talking is all they're doing. They're not presenting it to the public in a way that would be interesting to them.
It's like nobody wants to take the next step. They don't want to move into any kind of new territory with this. It's safer, easier, more comfortable. People have created little niches for themselves, little names for themselves, and they kind of want to propagate that. And human nature directs us to seek out the things that provide comfort and that are the known, you know, to stick with the known. And, like, it's not easy to venture off into the unknown and leap off the edge of a cliff. But that's what we need to do here. And until that happens, I don't think we're going to make any progress.
Mm-hmm.
Like you just said, it'll continue to be a circular kind of a discussion. It can't be allowed to die off as just the fad of the 90s. It's really important to continue to raise public awareness and public consciousness about this issue, because UFOs are an issue. Ufology is an issue. It's a serious issue. It's a major issue. And the work that you do and that, you know, guys like Dave Cherniak and others do in terms of keeping it in the public awareness is vitally important work.
Yeah, well, somebody has to do it. And again, I repeat my mantra. It's my assignment whether I choose to accept it or not.
Or not.
Yeah. John Velez, I want to thank you for joining us again, and I trust it won't be too long before we do it again. And I want to remind listeners that the archive that you are accessing has other programs with John Velez, and I do believe that even one or two of them have descriptions of John's abductions and his experiences. I don't want to say experiencer again in front of John.
Hey, Errol, it's always a pleasure spending time with you. And next time we get together, we'll discuss experiences.
We'll talk to you soon.
We'll talk to you again, Errol. Always a pleasure.
Bye.
Bye.
And that's it for the April 21st edition of this program. Trust you found things interesting. Until the next program, thank you for being out there. Thank you for downloading. And look forward to the next one. Bye.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.